Welcome to the Creative Shift Podcast. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. Today I'm chatting with Christine Coe, and she takes us behind the scenes of her creative shift. And I love this so much. So she spent like a decade in academia. She has a phrase in this interview where she says, "I had a triple postdoctoral fellowship appointment at Harvard Medical, MIT, and Mass General Hospital." And she spent years developing this ludicrously difficult career and really achieving, I think, what a lot of people dream of in their career. And then she walked away from it. And she walked away from it because she wanted to be, in her words, creative, independent, and making stuff. And she's done exactly that. And it's what's so interesting to me in this interview is that a lot of times in our life, we are defined by our job, by our career. And when I find someone who makes a big shift like this, boy, does that get my attention. But what Christine has done too is fascinating because it wasn't just a pivot from I was this and now I'm that. Since around 2006 or so, she has done a wide range of creative projects. And this day, her career and her interests are fueled by her passion. And they're also really multifaceted. She has a parenting blog and a podcast and a book and a design company and many other things. And to me, it is just such an inspiring example of what it means to really take the reins of your life and take the risk, and especially doing so when it might seem to other people foolish. The idea that you have achieved something that is very rare and very valuable and you make a shift, you change that. And what's so inspiring to me throughout this episode is not just how she followed her own path, but how she was surrounded by friends and family who supported her. And my goodness, that is just so meaningful. So I loved chatting with Christine, and I know you're going to love this interview. Hey everyone, this is Dan Blank, and I'm excited to be chatting with Christine Coe. Welcome.
Hi, Dan. I'm so delighted to be here.
So this podcast talks about the idea of a creative shift, which is making an intentional shift in your life around creative work, around career, around personal vision and how you want to live. And going through your bio and looking at what you've done, it's so interesting because it seems like there's sort of one maybe super major shift, but then there are, my estimate, 1,000 tiny shifts.
yeah, there has been a lot of shifting over the years.
So I feel like it probably makes more sense to start at the beginning, because it's interesting to think about how one is known professionally and maybe as an adult, and then when there's a shift, what that means. That identity shift, I think, is harrowing and terrifying for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Where do we start for what I guess I might call the first part of your life, the first part of your career? Do we start in grade school? Do we start at age 25?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just back up and say that I love that you do a podcast that's focused on creativity and professional shifting, because I just feel like the professional landscape is so different now. And the options, like if you just think back to our parents' generation and it was like one linear trajectory and that was it, right? You know, we have so many, this, even though it can be terrifying and harrowing, as you said, like the options we have are just so wonderful. But I would say that my central professional identity, I guess it started back in college and led me on a path. Like all good Korean kids, I played violin for some 20 plus years and was kind of on a semi-professional, you know, path there. But in college, I also was thinking, you know, I'm also a very practical Korean. So I was like, I need something steady and solid and not just relying on music. And I discovered psychology and the fact that there was this whole field of music and psychology. So I then decided, okay, I'm going to be a professor. I went to Wheaton College in Massachusetts and had the most incredible educational experience there. And just felt like, okay, I'm going to come back and be a professor at Wheaton with my professors, and it's going to be amazing. And so, you know, I went on this journey to become an academic, and I did a master's at Brandeis, and then I did a PhD at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and then I got to arguably the sort of fanciest professional place you could be as an academic. I returned to Boston, which is my home base, and had a triple postdoctoral fellowship appointment at Harvard Medical, MIT, and Mass General Hospital. So it was like, you can't get fancier than that, I think.
What does that mean, a triple postdoctorate?
It just means that I had in-name formal appointments. I was really toggling mostly between running experiments and seeing patients at Mass General Hospital and MIT.
Working a little bit at each of them.
Yes. My research projects needed the different institutions to make them happen. So it was terrifying. You know, I had to learn how to code in MATLAB at MIT, which was probably the most daunting experience ever. I was doing the work. And I think part of that journey was really feeling like I needed to get there, because I know nobody believes me when I tell them this, but as a sort of middle to high schooler, I was not a very good student. You know, stuff didn't click. I didn't get it. That traditional learning environment didn't work for me. But then I went on to get this fancy degree, and I think I always felt like an imposter through it. So I think I needed to get to that really fancy postdoctoral fellowship to realize, this is just a job. These are just people. I'm good now. And that's when I decided, you know, a lot of things were changing in my life. I had just become a mother. My dad was dying. And I was like, you know what? I'm good at academia, but if I want to suffer the way I've got to suffer as a junior faculty member in the Boston area, I just don't love it enough. And I want to do something else that's more flexible and creative. And so after a decade in, you know, devoting my life to academia, I was like, all right, I'm done. So it's sort of crazy.
All right. So we've got to back up, because there's so much in there. The first is your sort of the violin stuff. And I mean, you mentioned the guitar behind me when we got on the phone. There's a guitar behind me and I've been on this 2-year journey of finally learning how to actually play this instrument after a quarter century of dabbling. And as an adult, I'm like 46, 47, something like that. I forget. As an adult to do it, it's a very humbling thing to just suck at something.
Oh, yeah.
And to suck at it for months and months and months and months. And, you know, it's just an unending stream of that.
Yeah.
When did you first start playing violin?
Well, I started in third grade, and, you know, it was interesting because my mom had a love of music, and ultimately, you know, she had taught herself how to play piano, and she had bought this violin when she was in nursing school, and she never played it because all of a sudden she had a family and then had 7 children and there was no time. So I have her violin. That's what I, you know, played on as an adult. I know. I'm like, I should give it back to her. I'm not really using it. But you know, she was really into it. My dad, who was super practical, was like, music is fluff. This is ridiculous. And so actually there were several years where my mom, because my music teachers at school were like, she has some natural musical ability, get her private lessons. And my mom snuck me around. Like, I don't know where she got the money, but she snuck behind my dad's back to get me lessons.
Wait, she snuck you to violin lessons?
She did. Yeah, she did. And, you know, it was so funny. I just got on this track where I was doing competitions and, you know, being the concertmaster of the orchestra and all this stuff. And
what is that like as a kid? Because, I mean, I've got a 9-year-old and a 2-year-old, and not competitive in that way, but I see it all around me. And I can see that too, where there's such a level between my kid takes piano, then my kid's good at piano, they're involved thing. And then there's like what you're describing is sort of like a stratospheric level. What is that like as a child to be a part of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is positive. You know, it kind of gives you sort of an identity and something to sink yourself into. On the other hand, it's super intense. I had many teachers who made me cry. Like, it was not really that fun. That part of it was not fun. I am somebody, you know, I know this about myself, who I love performing. So in college, I would do solo recitals, step out, and I'd be like, let's do it. You know, like, whereas I know that, you know, performance anxiety is a real paralyzing thing for people. Yeah. I would say the one major negative is there were other things that I would have loved to do. Like, I know now about myself that I would have loved to be a part of a sports team as a kid, and that was not an option because I had to spend so much time on this one thing. So, you know, it really is a tricky balance as a parent. And the interesting thing that has fallen out since then is I have not pushed either of my children, 15 and 8, into music at all. And in fact, I just said to my husband the other day, I'm like, I can't believe I haven't like pushed this on them at all. Like, it's just, but I think maybe I just had so much pushing in my own experience that I just didn't want to do it.
What is there a way to characterize like the hours in a day or a week? And I don't even know what age you'd pick from, but I'm always curious about that because researching guitar, I mean, again and again, when I find an instructor I love, there'll be an interview and they're like, oh yeah, I'm in college or high school, 10 hours a day, and these crazy numbers of learning. What was it like for you?
Yeah, as a kid, I mean, I think it was probably more, I mean, if I practiced a half hour, an hour a day, it was good. But in college, it was definitely more like 3 hours a day, and which was challenging in addition to I was a double major. I was the editor of the newspaper, all this other stuff. So it was a lot.
And okay, so do you think that that affected any other part of your career? Because I think that there's such an interesting discipline of craft. And I do think it's different that if you have to sit at a piano, either by yourself or with an instructor, or going to a soccer team, which is another intense thing, there's team dynamics, there's all this other stuff. But when you're in a room alone for an hour or 3 hours, it feels different. Did that affect any other part of how you operate or your career?
You know, this is fascinating, Dan, because I don't think I've ever really thought of that comparison, because both of my kids are sports kids. But and now it's coming to me a little more clearly, but I am, who knows if it's nature or nurture or all those lessons and being by myself, but I am a workhorse when it comes to getting stuff done. I can put my head down and power through, and I don't know if that's a function of all those years, you know, toiling away by myself. I value autonomy and being able to get things done. And I have had to learn, in fact, to be a team player. So I think you're onto something.
I always just think of the discipline involved with that. And then how can one help someone get that kind of discipline? But that isolation can be amazing for some people, and it can be, you know, it's horrible for other people. So.
Yeah. Well, I love that you're taking guitar lessons as an adult oh my goodness, it is humbling. You know, 2 summers ago, I was like, I want to play guitar, but I kind of want to just pick it up and be great at it, which obviously didn't happen. But I went to a friend of mine in town is a music teacher, and she ran like a women's guitar workshop. And so 6 of us learned together, and it was so different than anything I had ever done. And it was so welcoming and loving. I was like, this is very different from my music classes in the past. And it was lovely, but it's humbling learning as an adult from scratch, I gotta say.
It's nice to get a community for that. That was so good.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you went into academia, as you say. And it's always interesting to me when someone goes into college and then the goal becomes the thing that they're in. Like, it's like very meta. It's like, I want to teach at this college like my professor does. And then you get all these unbelievable degrees, which, I mean, how many years of schooling was that?
Let's see. So After undergrad, I had done a sort of senior project on music and psych. And so I'd already started the foundation there. And then I spent 3 years, I think, at Brandeis University because I was working there as a lab manager, and I got my master's at the same time because as a full-time employee, I could get my master's paid for. So it was sort of a strategic thing. So that was sort of 3 years, but kind of part-time study. And then I did my PhD in 4 years because Queen's actually took my master's credit. And then it was another 3 years for the PhD. So, you know, it was really probably 7, 10, yeah, a solid decade, like a post-undergrad, you know, devoted to music and brain neuroscience.
So I always think of, I always used to like the movie, The Paper Chase.
Oh, which, I haven't seen it. Okay.
Which, you know, like 1980, maybe it's about law school. And it just, you know, shows that when you're for these difficult majors or advanced degrees, what is asked of you is superhuman. You know, it's meant to break you down. It is meant to make you perform at the optimum level. And it is something that takes years. It's not just got a big paper due at the end. It's like, no. This is years of this kind of work. And the work sounds really difficult when you say these phrases like neuroscience. Like, it just seems like this type of thing that to me, who's always been a creative, it's always the thing where you're like, that sounds so impressive and terrifying. And I think that that makes it even more interesting to me, this idea of a shift of someone who spends a decade in school, who attains a career, earns a career that, like, I realize, oh, Harvard, MIT, this or that. You're like, oh my gosh, like this, this sounds like, as you said, the top that you could expect. And then what you do after that is you cling to your, you cling to these positions because it's never going to get any better. Am I mischaracterizing that in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think it is, it was so intense. And I, you know, I mean, I cried during my violin lessons, but I really cried, you know, I remember right before my PhD defense, I was on a bench with my husband overlooking Lake Ontario. And I was just sobbing. I was like, they're all going to find out I'm a total fraud. They're going to, I'm going to fail. Like, you know, it just, all of us, no matter how successful somebody may portray on the outside, everyone has self-doubt. And it's interesting, I was just doing some writing about this morning, but sometimes I'm a little bit amazed that, and I think this is where the inner critic and the self-criticism can come in, but, you know, I spent a decade being highly trained, like just you couldn't be more trained, went from that career to a career where I'm self-taught everything. So it's inevitable to feel like, okay, you know, am I making this up? Are people going to think, you know, what the heck is she doing? But I mean, it's been working out okay.
So let's talk about that big shift. So you're working these jobs and you're saying there's a lot going on. Like, you started a family. Like, what was the first domino to fall that made you think, huh, maybe I want to shift?
Yeah. Well, I think, obviously, as you know, parenthood is very, it changes all your perspective around. So that was definitely one thing, was actually sort of, I guess, maybe the first real domino to shift was, it turned out my postdoc advisor was crazy. And the relationship was just, the whole arrangement was not super healthy. And so that was the first thing, kind of adding friction. And then actually, the weekend before I was supposed to return back to my postdoc from maternity leave, my dad got very sick and my parents were supposed to be my childcare. So that put a wrench in things. And I said, okay, we've got to shift things around. And I kind of did all this rearranging to go back, you know, part-time and sort of ramp up back up to full-time until I could figure out childcare. So that was kind of the second big thing. And then, you know, just parenting and like just thinking about, if I'm going to spend time away from people I love, I want to be doing something I really care about. And I just found I didn't care anymore about, you know, the fancy sounding work I was doing. I wanted to be creative. I wanted to be independent. I wanted to be making stuff, whether it was with my hands or on the internet or whatever. And, you know, finally the stress of the job and the situation with my advisor, it was actually taking a physical toll on me. Like, my hair was falling out and I was like just a wreck. And my husband said, you know, just jump. Like, that was kind of one of the biggest gifts he gave to me. He's like, we have, my job is steady enough. We've got benefits. Just jump. You'll figure it out. I know you'll land. And so it's, I have never not had a plan. So to just leave at the end of my postdoc and not have anything formal, like, I had started my blog and it was starting to kick up, but it wasn't making money at that point. That was terrifying, but it ended up being the most freeing and beautiful thing in the world.
So there's a lot in there too. Something I always think about is how we have this really strange culture that seems to put kids on a fast track from age 13 on of, what are you good at? What do you want to do? If you don't figure it out in high school, then you better figure it out immediately in college. You know, it's sort of like this thing. And a lot of people, whatever they go into at 21, 22, 23, they're already stuck in it. Because by the time you get to 28 or 32, and you've achieved any kind of seniority, even if you started off in retail, now you're the manager, to shift means giving up all that you've done. And something that I've, I mean, with these interviews, with my clients, with just what I do, what's always fascinated me is that someone at 33 or 43 or 53 or 63 is a different person, is another evolution of who they are, and they might want to do something different. And it's interesting to hear how you were saying, I wanted to do something different. Did that have any, before you kind of jumped and did it, were you like reading kinds of books? Were you doing these things? Was it, did you have a focus to it? Or was it like, we didn't know, that came later?
Yeah, I think I was just surviving. I was just trying to survive. And I think really probably what gave me the sort of glimpse of possibility was, I had started Boston Mamas. That was 2006. And I was literally working on this website. You know, I'm like a very research driven person. So it sort of started kind of because people would ask me for all these ideas and information about baby stuff. And I said, well, I wish there was somewhere like I could just put all this stuff and then I can just share it with people. And my tech friend Andrew was like, that would be a blog and you should start one. And so I think when people started to respond to that, I started to feel like the possibility of something creative bubbling. And also I think conversations with people I really cared about helped a lot. You know, we can never underestimate human connection and our friends who know us and really see us 100%. And I had several friends who were like, yeah, never thought this whole like working in a laboratory thing was your personality anyway. Like, go get them.
That's amazing.
I'm like a very like social kind of forward facing person. So I think my career, though impressive sounding, was sort of confusing to people. Maybe they understood the professor goal part of it and being in front of a classroom and inspiring the next generation of thinkers. But the whole toiling away in a lab thing, you know, it was many of my friends were confused. And then just one last interesting thing on that. You know, I think one of the scariest things about that shift was preparing myself for the reaction, you know, from my advisors, people who had invested time in me, specifically my PhD advisor, my mom. And I think the place where I was like, okay, you just have to accept and like make this jump was my mom. My dad had died by this point. And she said to me, she actually said, Christine, do what you want to do. You just need to do what makes you happy. Okay, let me just say that Korean mothers do not normally say that. So that was where I was like, okay, surrender and just, you know, this is the time.
It's always so interesting to me to look at the value of who you surround yourself with or collaborators. It's neat to hear what you said about your mom, because I do think that most people, and it's different for everyone who it is and what it would be, but we want to make people happy. We love these different people. We have an expectation of what they're going to think. Oh, I know what my mom's going to say. I know what she's going to say.
Yes.
And it's amazing when they surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
Yeah.
What was that about, do you think? Was it the phase of life she was in? Was it?
You know, I think she and my dad had a very hard life. You know, they were immigrants and they had worked so hard, like, you know, with a classic kind of bodega convenience kind of business and raising seven children in the Boston area. I mean, it was no joke. And I think, you know, she had really felt like, okay, now it's time. We're finally going to retire and get rid of this stupid store and like, and enjoy life. And then my dad got really sick. So I think she just was very much in a place where she felt like you have to just enjoy what's in front of you as best you can. And so I don't think that her comment could have come maybe 10 years earlier, you know, when she was still in the thick of like status is what matters. Yeah. It was just the timing, you know, she could support me unconditionally. And it just meant the world to me. It makes me a little teary just thinking about it, because that's not, you know, Koreans, especially, they're kind of status driven and accomplishment oriented. So that was a really big statement for her.
And then what you said, your husband is saying, like, just jump. I always think of that too. One, because, you know, marriage is a partnership in many ways, and how even for him, one, it's great to have someone who's that supportive, but this can be a very threatening thing for a spouse who feels like, well, we got married, we had a kid. That spouse has their own thing going on too, where it's not that it can feel threatening, but it can change their own security or their own expectation. And it sounds like you'd met him earlier where he'd kind of gone with you through at least part of the years of all the education, which I'm sure was not cheap, and we know it wasn't easy. Was there a journey that you think he went on with this too, to get to that point, or was it, no, that's how he is?
Well, I would, it's probably a mix. I think he is one of the most emotionally tuned in, he's a therapist, or he's one of the most emotionally tuned in human beings I know. And I think he actually was also at that time experiencing a considerable level of job dissatisfaction. So I think he felt like, hey, I've got the means to help you jump, just do it. And then as it turned out, we switched places and he ended up leaving. He has a, you know, two masters and a business degree and all this stuff. And he ended up leaving the consulting world to become a therapist. So I supported him during that jump, you know, that happened after mine. And it was just kind of incredible the way it worked out. But I think he in that moment was feeling very like I can deal with this long enough right now. So you do it. And then I might need to lean on you later.
I love it. And it's amazing that you had friends around you as well who were supportive. Because again, it's an area where I see a lot of people, the friends have put you in a box. And when you change that box, it does threaten them, because likely they are living a complicated, stressful life, and they have justified, well, that's just life. You got to keep working. And when you break out, it can disrupt that. But it's awesome that you had so many cool people in your life that were supportive of this.
It's such a blessing. And it's funny now, like, I have a very, very good friend dating back to middle school who, I have since encouraged, like, I helped her make her jump. And so I take great pride in the fact that she says, yeah, Christine's the person who made me quit my job. But now she's doing something she loves and something super creative. So it's wonderful.
So 2006 for blogging was not quite the Wild West, but that's about when I started. And it was very early. It was an era where I remember I had a corporate job at the time. I worried about getting fired.
Yes.
Because I had a public blog. And nowadays we put things in Facebook and Twitter and whatever. And like back then, it was just like walking into traffic. You know, is what it felt like. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you when someone said, oh, you should share this and we're going to get out there and you build the blog? Did it feel like I'm on the cusp of the hot new trend? Did it feel scary? Did it feel natural?
I love we're both old guard, huh? But I think I was so clueless about, I like to joke with my husband because he went to business school. I'm like the entrepreneur with no business plan. Like I'm a super gut-oriented person. So I don't make like, I'm not doing like project capacity planning and all this stuff. I'm just kind of like, I have a feeling about this and this seems like it's going to be good. And so I should just like follow this. So, you know, at that time I had just started, I realized that in all the different projects and businesses that I've started over the years, I have in some way, explicit or not, identified a hole or the thing that I was looking for and then said, all right, let's create it. And so at that time, in that specific example, in Boston, there were calendar sites, but there was no like kind of lifestyle editorial. I'm like, the city needs something like this. I guess I'll just create it. And when all of a sudden people started coming and commenting and emailing, I was like, oh yeah, okay. I guess this makes sense. People really need this. We're fulfilling a need. It's all good. And it just sort of like went crazy from there.
So like what was on the site in the beginning? Because I can see you're like, oh, parenting advice. We mentioned the word like local lifestyle. And I think of a city like Boston, which is gorgeous and amazing. And at the time there would have been countless magazines and web and things serving it. What were you sharing? What was the site about?
Oh, it was such a mix. It would be like, you know, really cool events, like one-off events that were coming up that I thought was cool. Gear that I thought was cool. So, you know, products, recipes, kind of the whole gamut, which is why I say just like generally lifestyle. And, you know, just fun. I always like finding sort of the like little local gems that people might not know about, that kind of thing. And, you know, it's since expanded considerably. You know, I have three people who work for me on the site and, it's a lot of work, but it's great. And, so it's definitely now, you know, we offer a camp guide to help people. Like I just basically want to funnel the information. People are really busy. And I think in all the work I do, I want to try to just make it as easy for people to access the information they want and then get on with their day.
How did this, because I remember that time, but that time is not much different than now, was this idea of growth and virality and monetization. This idea that like we could do guides, then we can have classes, and then we can have a forum. Then we'll have a membership forum too for $4 a month. It's really cheap. Then I can imagine all the pressure to grow and build this and become a huge business. Did you experience that, and how have you navigated that?
Yeah, I think there have been plenty of those moments where I've been like, well, I should be doing X, Y, or Z. I knew at the very beginning, for example, as a real concrete example, you know, one way that a lot of hyperlocal sites will, you know, make their money through page views and then advertising and all that is by building a calendar where people have to click through in order to find each thing. And it's sort of a maddening experience and it makes me crazy. So I was like, I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to do the opposite thing that makes no business sense and like, you know, make it really easy for people. So I think it's always been my gut sort of driving things. And I'm like, I don't really want to build a membership community for $4 a month where I don't want to manage that. I've mostly followed my nose on with the litmus test of one, is this useful? And then, you know, is this something that people, it'll make their lives easier? And then two, do I actually want to do it and implement it or, you know, hire staff to do it? And so, you know, maybe people will come to the site and be like, she doesn't have a calendar, you know, like a formal calendar that I can click 3 months in advance and see. Well, sorry, you can get that somewhere else. So yeah, I've just followed my nose on it the whole way, I think.
What has the evolution been? Because you mentioned, oh, I've got three people working on it. And I mean, 2006, we're talking, you know, close to 15 years ago. Are there like phases of it? Or has it been, no, this is, you know, it's largely been the same vision and we just keep evolving it.
Yeah, largely the same vision. At the very beginning, I was a neurotic freak about content. I would try to post 3 to 5 times daily. I can't even believe I used to do that. I mean, they'd be short posts. You know, now it's one post a day max probably, and it's just
but
fine.
I do remember that era of blog growth, whether it was TechCrunch or Design Sponge or whatever, where everyone was trying to figure it out. It was exploding. And I'm actually curious of your take on this, where you would hear, oh, Design Sponge is blowing up or whatever. And there'd be all these algorithms. Oh, you got to do people on 3 times a day, and the political blogs changed and everything changed. Did you have any sense of comparisonitis or even hearing that and being like, oh, maybe, oh, wow, look at what Gawker is doing. They have now they went from one site to 20 sites and that sort of thing. Did that ever get to you in that kind of way that maybe now we look at Instagram and there's comparisonitis of like, gosh, suddenly she has 4 million followers. Why don't I have that? That sort of thing.
There's always, I mean, this landscape we're living in now is so ripe for comparisonitis. I think I had a brief window at the beginning where I thought, well, maybe I'll franchise this. So I probably bought a dozen other domains like Chicago Mamas and whatever else. And then, you know, about a year after holding those domains, I was like, I'm never going to do that. I don't want to do that. I want to build something different. You know, I built a design business and a podcast and I wrote a book. Like there were other things I wanted to do. So I've just had to kind of really, it's easy to get distracted, right? We live in this, as wonderful as the creative space is, there's also so much, there's a lot you can feel bad that you're not doing. And I've just had to kind of stay focused on what I enjoy doing and, you know, what I'm willing to put my time towards, because the time is precious, you know, and you know, you've got little kids. It has to matter.
So what was the next thing that you started creating or launching? Because there's a list here.
Yeah. So the next thing, I shuttered this business a little while ago, but I started a design, like a stationery and custom design company. I am not a trained graphic artist. And what literally happened was so to my earlier point about identifying a hole and then wanting to fill it, I was throwing a baby shower for a friend of mine, and I wanted really cute shower invitations with a very specific icon. I wanted like a pregnant lady, but like a fashionable pregnant lady. You can probably find a million of these now. Looked all over the place, couldn't find them. And so I literally said to myself, well, I guess I'll download the free 30-day trial of Adobe Illustrator and see if I can learn how to create vector art. And I did. And People really responded to my design style and the stuff. I started making more stuff, and
wait,
all of a sudden,
wait, we're pausing on this because I remember learning Illustrator in 1998 while I saved up for my Bondi Blue iMac, the first one, and it took months. Illustrator,
it's fussy. Yeah,
it's confusing. The way vector art works is very different than what we think of with Canva or Photoshop. So what was that process like too? Because again, we got this thing with the violin and with the college where it's the idea of picking up a new skill. But I think that, what does that look like?
I think here's where my hours in solitude in the violin like really came into play. Cause I just sat down. I'm like, I'm not getting up until I figure this out.
Wow.
And that, I mean, it's both a strength and a detriment. I think that ability to kind of focus. And I mean, I actually literally have been this week working on an exercise with the encouragement of my husband to do that whole like thing that the eye doctors tell you, you know, every 20 minutes, take 20 seconds to look 20 feet or more away. Like I've been trying to reduce my eye strain because I, you know, if left to my own devices, I would sit and pound away at things. So, yeah, I think at that moment I just was like, I'm going to figure this out. I had a good knack for it. And like figuring out the angles and how that was all working. I am a visual person. Yeah, I just started making stuff and people started asking to buy it. And so then I thought, okay, I guess I'll put up a shop and see what happens. And then I started getting press. And
what does put up a shop mean back then?
Back then I designed now in my mind, this was like pre-Tiny Prints, pre-minted, all that fancy engine stuff. This was like a simple HTML-based website that was not super fancy. I mean, it looked nice, but it was not super fancy. And it had a PayPal shopping cart, and people started ordering stuff. And then...
Was it through also just either the site or your network of Boston Mamas that people got to know it, or did it happen totally outside of that?
It was both, because I had, you know, people I knew in the internet space who, you know, would review it. But then I had, you know, like... you know, at that time it doesn't exist anymore, but like Cookie Magazine, like print, you know, Pregnancy and Newborn, like different outlets were just finding me somehow. So all of a sudden, you know, it was a business making money. And then I got to a point many years later where I was like, I think I'm done with this.
Well, that's another thing too, where I can see anyone, and with a lot of, you know, artists and illustrators and creative people listening to this, where, oh man, if I just got in to that like cool hipster design wedding favor thing before all these other things, oh, I would kill it. But the reality for anyone at any time is that the market is complicated. Your interests are complicated. Business is complicated.
Yeah.
Did you ever look at that and say, I'm going all in? Or was it, no, this was a good business. I did it. It was one of many things I did, and it kind of ran its course.
Definitely the latter. I think I got to a point where I was like, I either have to go all in independent, like as just me, or, you know, try to sell it or try to scale in some way and outsource, you know, the printing. And because I was doing everything, I was doing the printing and the packaging and, you know, all the collateral and everything at home. And it was like, it was exhausting. And so, it was both wonderful and exhausting. And so, yeah, I think at one point I was just like, I think I've run the course on this. I have other things I want to try and do. And, you know, this was good. So in a sense, I do remember feeling like if I close this business, are people going to think that I failed at it? But I was kind of like, no, I'm closing this business because I'm done with it. And, you know, that's okay.
I love that. So clearly for a period of time, you're doing kind of both of these things at once. What's the next thing that was created?
What was the next thing? So I think the next thing was probably my book that I co-authored with Asha Dornfest, which is called Minimalist Parenting. So that was 2013. And it's funny, you know, she and I were both longtime bloggers, you know, like you, she had been blogging maybe even since 2004. And we both have a sort of similar outlook on life about trying to just kind of like simplify and tune out the crazy noise and, you know, just get more in tune with what you want to do. And I remember I was at a conference, I was speaking at this conference and giving a key, like a talk about how to do less and enjoy life more. And people were really responding to it. And a bunch of people came up to me and were like, you need to write a book. And so in classic Christine Coe fashion, on the plane ride home at the airport, I bought a domain name for minimalist parenting. And then I wrote an outline for the book. And when I got home, I called my friend Asha and I said, do you want to write this book with me? And so there, off we went. And it was really, you know, quite amazing because we have actually very different working styles. Like I'm a very like bottom up kind of processor and she's very top down and I call her my Yoda. But we ended up just having this incredible complementary work style to write the book. And writing that book was so joyful. I know a lot of authors talk about how onerous writing is, but it was truly joyful.
Was it joyful because you had a collaborator, you had a co-author?
I think so. And it also just felt good to create. Like I remember at that time, I put on my calendar every morning. I just had an hour of brain dumping into our Google Docs. And I said to Asha, I'm like, just a warning. I'm just brain dumping. It's going to be ugly and I'll like wordsmith it all later. But just that I hadn't realized, you know, until that point, like how much I identify as a writer, how much I love putting words on the page. And it just felt so free to just write and not worry about editing it all as I was going.
I love that. What was the process like from have this idea, have the collaborator and join the process to the book is published, the book is out there, the more business end of it?
Oh my gosh. Publishing a book is nutty. It's incredible and it's totally nutty. I don't know if we were working with a smaller publisher based in Boston and that's since been acquired, but it was exciting and it felt really humbling to do kind of book tour type stuff and have people show up. And I think one of my sort of childhood pieces of baggage is always worrying that people aren't going to show up. So it was just so moving to have people show up and be so supportive of the book and, you know, what we were trying to talk about.
Oh, I love that. I always think of the uniqueness of a book, like in a platform where like you do a website, you do a community, all that, there are these things, but there's something about a book that just feels different.
It is. It's a little like giving birth maybe. And it's actually funny, just sidebar, I don't know how many people know this story. Actually, I don't know how much I talked about it on tour, but I probably didn't. But I remember at the time, you know, they came back, our publisher came back with a cover design. And, you know, by this time I had done a considerable amount of design work and I was like, not happening. Like that is not happening. And so it's perhaps a little control freaky of me, but I talked to Asha and then I was like, I'm going to send them back a mock-up of what I think the book cover should look like. And hence I became a book jacket author.
Isn't that great? It's funny how often that comes up in conversations I have with people or on the podcast, which is even one that thought, but then how difficult it is to go back to your publisher and say, this thing that you said you're doing, I don't have any control over, we're going to do a little bit differently.
Yeah. I think it's important to advocate when it's something you've poured your heart into, you know, you have to, otherwise you're going to feel bad about it. You have to at least try, I think.
I love that. So what came next?
What came next? Well, I guess there are three things that came next. I'll try not to dwell too long, but maybe a little short runway of time after the book launched, I had already been thinking, I think I want to do a podcast. And I think I want it to be not parenting focused. I mean, it could include parenting, but more general, what I called at the time, lifestyle editing. And that's when I asked Asha if she'd be willing to do a podcast with me called Edit Your Life. And so we started that 3 years ago. And that has just been delightful. As you know, podcasting is just wonderful. And then the two other projects, actually one that started well before that, is I am the creative director for a social media agency where we're like social media for social good. So all of our clients tend to be like places like the American Cancer Society or, you know, Tobacco Free Kids or all this stuff. So I build kind of crazy programs for people. Like I'm like the person with the weird idea. And then, the last thing, and then you can ask questions on any of these things, is a couple of years, well, after the 2016 election, I was rather devastated, as was my husband, and we were feeling a little uncertain of what to do and how to help different people who were probably going to be in the crosshairs a bit based on the new administration, and maybe in a week or two decided to start an online apparel company called Brave New World Designs, where it's housed on Etsy, but the idea is that a percentage of the proceeds for each design go to an organization that's related to the design. Totally did not expect to do that. That was the unexpected business of 2016.
Well, the fifth business, the fifth concurrent business is always the unexpected one.
Because it doesn't make sense to start it, right? It's Lunikins.
But I mean, there is such a common thread through everything of you had a genuine interest and you act on it.
I am good at the action part, yeah.
That's amazing. It's totally amazing.
It's a little crazy, but yes, it's been wonderful. I mean, and through that business, we've given away thousands of dollars over the years to like different organizations. And that part is just wonderful. That makes me so happy.
So why launch a podcast? And I help, you know, a lot of my clients start, I help them start podcasts. And I remember the sort of podcast renaissance, which I call it, which might have been about when you got on, but podcasting is a lot of work. And it doesn't often have a business attached to it. But what was it about that work that drew you to, but also kept you going with it?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. It is a ton of work, as we both know. I think it occurs to me that we started at a time when the internet and the old school blogs, as we know it, were changing a lot, and everything was like monetization. That's like the first question anybody ever asked me about when they don't know anything about what I do is, how do you monetize stuff? And I think the beautiful intimacy and ability to go deeper into a topic like we're doing right now, and hearing somebody's voice in your ears was so powerful to me as a listener that I thought, I think this would be a good way to like communicate with people, to create community, to make people feel like they weren't alone. And those are all those things have all served their purpose. You know, it's funny, my husband, who is a genius therapist, is our most requested guest.
Do you mean he's just an awesome therapist, or does he actually only give therapy to geniuses?
He is an amazing therapist. Okay. I actually have my own therapist, but I try not to take advantage of him on a daily basis. So he's been on the podcast a few times, four times, I think. And in our one end of the year survey, everybody was like, more John Baxter, please, please bring him back more. And so he's super smart, but, you know, he was saying on the last recording we did that we were responding to a listener letter, and I had read the letter most, you know, excerpted, but mostly, and he commented at that time, the amount of trust and that your listeners have with you guys is just astounding. Like they feel connected to you as human beings, and it's really, really powerful. And so I think that's what drew me to it and what continues to, you know, fuel our passion for it today.
I love that. So how does social media fit into this? Because, you know, it feels like, you know, you have, you know, all these followers on Twitter and Pinterest and Facebook and Instagram and all of that. How much of your life does that become, especially too, because it's one of your jobs too?
It is one of my jobs. Well, I will tell you something radical that I did after the new year. So I actually still love social media. I know that, you know, it kind of gets a bad rap sometimes. My favorite place is Instagram, actually, because I hate the algorithm, but I love the sort of connection to people and the conversations that happen there. And I actually have found myself doing some sort of microblogging there, which has been very interesting. But the radical thing that I did after the new year is I found myself just far too scattered. You know, when I would come to my phone to do something, like I would come to my phone, it would just be littered with notifications. And then I go down.
That phrase is still funny to me, maybe because of like, just the idea of like, we go to do something. The first thing you do is you go to this little square, this little rectangle.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy, right? So, you know, there'll be all these notifications on the top bar, and then I would go down a rabbit hole, and then I would not remember why I was there in the first place, which made me very upset. So what I did was I mostly through the day, I used my phone like a phone. I turned off all the notifications except the phone and the texting, and I actually have it on silent most of the time. So when I would go to my phone to actually do something, whether I was checking Instagram, it would be me going because you know, I wanted to do it, not because I was getting kind of sucked in from the other side. There was more intentionality around it. And I have to say, it's been a game changer. It's been incredible for to sort of reduce the sort of mindless scrolling. So yes, I'm on social media every day for work and personally because I enjoy it. And it's tricky stuff for people to navigate, for sure, myself included.
It is. I mean, something I always look at is there's, you know, I work with so many different writers and creators who are trying to develop a platform. So yes. They look at someone, and I'll say someone such as yourself, who's built a following, thousands of followers, different platforms. And they often have this perception that, well, if I could just have the 10,000 followers, it's like, it's done. I have my people, I can announce things and people do it. Like that sort of solves things. This is a very general question, but what is the reality of that? And this is something I spend a lot of time thinking about because I do these social media case studies where I look at things and I'm like, this person getting 30 likes, even though they've got 20,000 followers, like, you know, that doesn't give them this power that we all hope they have that makes things easy. What is it really like for you in that capacity?
I mean, I think there, for anybody on social media or on the internet, there is a little bit, I mean, actually Asha said it once about the podcast, that you put something out there and you hope it will be helpful, but you really have no idea if anybody's listening. I mean, I guess you have downloads and whatever, but I think I've learned over the years not to get hung up on the numbers. I mean, because let's face it, on social media, there's plenty of gaming where a lot of those numbers aren't even real. And I think you just have to stay focused on the work and like what the pieces that you love to do. And actually, one of the things in my line of backwards recommendations that I sometimes give people is, you know, I remember I was giving these business workshops at the Mass Conference for Women, and, you know, all these small business owners were asking me for advice about social, and they felt like they had to be everywhere. And I was like, it's worse to be everywhere and not really be there than to be on one channel you really care about and do it well. So pick that thing and do it well, because not everybody, you know, not for me, I feel like I have a real eye for things that will play and differ in the different social spaces. But, you know, people don't always have that, especially artists and creators. Like, they have their stuff they're making, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that is a really tricky thing for creatives who also want to build a platform. And you know what I'd say to that is consider email, consider building your own newsletter list that you own. I mean, that's how we got connected, right? I actually just, you know, in the past month or two started my own newsletter just for me. And I have to say, it has been the most joyful thing to write. I just love it. You know, so I own it. So I would recommend that to people who might be a little daunted by social, like, you know, develop your list and your people that way and reach them in the way that's going to work for you.
Love that. Covered a lot. Is there anything about any of these topics or themes that I haven't asked about, but we should definitely talk about?
Oh my goodness. You are a fantastic interviewer. I don't think there's anything major. I mean, I think I would just encourage, we cover comparison quite a bit, but I think that a big part of any creative shift that somebody's going to have is you have to give yourself the space for reflection. And, you know, also I would recommend to anybody who's listening is to perhaps, you know, connect with some trusted people who you can bounce ideas off of. I'm a big fan of, I call it my secret squirrels, and it's like, you know, the people I know are going to be brutally honest and also very supportive when I have another crazy idea, or if I'm really stuck on something, then I'll go to them and say, can you help me just brainstorm this a little bit? You know, and then I also offer to help with something they're working on. But just having, you know, it's hard when you're a creative to be working in a silo. You need other people.
I love that. Thank you so much for taking us through this. It's so fascinating to do this research and learn about you and be like, what does the journey really look like? So I appreciate kind of taking us inside of it.
Oh, thank you. I hope there was enough there for people to understand both the good, bad, and the ugly. It's all part of the journey.
You can find Christine Ko in a pretty wide variety of places. I guess you can start with her website, Christine Ko, that's K-O-H, ChristineKo.com. On Twitter, Boston Mamas. On Instagram, hello, Christine Ko. She has a book out, Minimalist Parenting, and she's got a lot of other things. Check out her website for that as well. You can find me, Dan Blank, at wegrowmedia.com, on social media, at Dan Blank. And, of course, my book, Be the Gateway. All right. Thank you so much for listening until the end.